Flashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 4, side 2.
Even when we began to climb into the craggy forest hills that lead up to the Raton Pass and the going got slower, the land was still beautiful with its winding wooded valleys. There's a fine toll road now, I believe, but in my time there was hardly a visible trail, and once or twice the wagons had to be carried bodily over rocky barriers. Then it was prairie again, to the heel of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and since all this had recently been Mexican territory, there were more olive faces than white in the little settlements, and that unwashed languor, inseparable from dagoes, began to pervade the scene. There were other branches of the trail now, and other caravans were commonplace. At Wagon Mound, a great grassy bottom surrounded by trees, we found more than 300 vehicles assembled, some of which had come down the Cimarron route, and with them, hollow-cheeked from illness, but laconic as ever, was Wooten. He had forced himself into the saddle and come on a week behind us, but a friendly Indian had misled him into thinking our whole train had crossed the river to the cut-off. He had followed and made a dreadful discovery. Our deserters had lost the trail, sure enough, and split into two parties after a violent quarrel. Wooten came on one group, more dead than alive, and had brought them safe to the Candian River. But the other party, including Skate and many of the Pittsburgh pirates, had been less lucky. "Pashes catched him on the Cimarron. Buffalo hunters seen the wagons all burned. Our folks massacred." It was a sobering reminder of what might lie over the next hill, but it would have taken every Indian in America to make an impression on the vast stream of wagons and immigrants now converging below Wagon Mound. It was an endless procession, and at Las Vegas, not to be confused with the better-known Las Vegas, Nevada, we met some of the trains which had been pouring across the southern plains all summer from Fort Smith. Spirits were sky-high now as we passed over rolling downland covered with trees and bushes and dwarf cedars sprung from earth that was red and rich. And one afternoon there was a great whooping and cheering as we sighted conical hills ahead, and the cry of "Santa Fe! Santa Fe!" re-echoed along the line. Sure enough, as we passed the great scrubby cones, there lay a vast plain, and before it, the little city that was the first in all Western America, built by the conquistadores. And God bless 'em, says I. There are bigger, finer, richer towns in the world, but precious few that so many weary folk have been so glad to see. On Wooten's advice, we camped near the soldiers' fort on the slope just north of the city, and that evening Susie and I drove in to take a long slant at the place, for we must break our journey here and take order for the final stage to the coast. It was like Calcutta in Fair Week. The town itself was no size at all. Some adobe houses and one or two fairly decent courtyards all grouped round a fine plaza containing the governor's palace, which was a long, low, colonnaded building, and the bishop's house, and dozens of stores and posadas. But to get to this, you had to pass through a positive forest of wagons and shanties and huts, and the paths through, like the streets of the town itself, were swarming with people. We were told that the usual population was about 1,000. In the fall of 49, I'd wager it was 10 times that. Most of them emigrants who, for one reason or another, found themselves stranded in the place, with no notion of how they were going to get out. The truth was, they couldn't afford it. They'd swallowed the gold bait back east, listened to the rosy lies of those who made a fortune from outfitting and transporting them, and then discovered, after a journey far slower and longer and more expensive than they'd expected, 500 miles to Santa Fe, the Fort Smith sharps had told them, it was 800, that they were out of cash, out of provisions, and out of luck. What little money they had left was swallowed by prices that were plain foolish. Flour at $1 for 10 pounds, sugar at 25 cents a pound, corn at $2.50 a bushel, firewood at 25 cents. Even grass was being offered in the streets by peasant hawkers at 20 cents the bunch, for there wasn't a mouthful of grazing for miles, and something like 6,000 cattle to feed. So the poor emigrants were reduced to selling even their rigs to buy food and shelter. And lo, a wagon that had cost them $200 now brought $50 if they were lucky. Their horses and oxen they could hardly give away, and the household goods and mining gear they offered in desperation fetched only cents. Many were plain destitute, unable to go forward or back, for now they learned that it would take another 6 months at least to California, that the routes, which no one was clear about, lay through terrible desert, alive with hostiles, and that no military escorts could be provided. This alarming news we learned from an earnest young subaltern of dragoons called Harrison, with whom we dined in the best of the plaza's restaurants, for with the press of customers, it was six to a small table even there, and a handsome bribe to the jefe at that. I doubt if one in ten of these poor souls will ever see California, says he. Even if they had the money and sure guides on good, well-guarded trails, it would be bad enough. As it is, he shrugged and recommended wine of El Paso, which was excellent, and a fricassee of tender buffalo hump with fiery peppers, called Chili Colorado, also first-rate if your belly happens to be lined with copper. If I'd eaten it at Bent's Fort, I could have blown the place up without gunpowder. I asked him why no escorts when the town was filled with soldiers, and he laughed. You hardly saw an Indian south of the Raton, I'll be bound. No, because the trails were full. Well, in Santa Fe, you're living in an armed camp with hostiles all around you. Comanches and Kiowas to the east, Utes to the north, Navajos to the west, and, worst of all, Apaches to the south. The reason we can't spare a single saber for escort is that we're never done just holding the brutes at bay, protecting the Del Norte settlements and punishing their raids, when we can find them. Yesterday I came back from the Galenas, where we lost two troopers in a skirmish with the Blacklegs. In 3 hours' time, I'll be riding out again with 50 men because there's word of a big band of mescaleros coming up the Pecos. No, sir, there isn't much time for escorts. Well, says Susie, that's fine, I must say. And what's the government doing about it, may I ask? Harrison shook his head. If by the government, ma'am, you mean the governor, Colonel Washington. Well, he came back to town yesterday, having spent 5 weeks chasing Navajos, with 400 infantry and troops of artillery. That's what the government spends its time doing in these parts. As Susie had said, this was fine. Some trains must be reaching California, surely, says I. Oh, certainly they have been, those that are large and well-armed and properly planned. Why, this summer they've been pouring down the Del Norte in thousands, floating across the Rio Grande on rafts and flatboats, taking any route west they can find, and getting there, I don't doubt. But there's no question Indian trouble's becoming worse, and I wouldn't advise anyone right now to try any but two roads, Kearney's Trail down to Socorro and west, but, he glanced at Susie, that's a man's road, if you'll forgive my saying so, ma'am. The other is down the Del Norte Valley, beyond Socorro to Donna Ana, and west to the Gila and San Diego. It's a long, hard haul, and I'd hate for my family to have to travel it. But if you provision for the desert, and arm for the Indians, and don't mind heat and dust, you'll get there. Susie wondered thoughtfully if it wasn't possible to hire a military escort, and Harrison smiled patiently. One escort did go out last month to convoy the new collector of San Francisco, but even he had to wait quite a time. I'm sorry, Mrs. Comer, there just aren't enough soldiers to go around. The truth was, it became plain, that in taking over the vast Mexican territory, the Yanks had bitten off more than they could comfortably chew, and like all governments, were trying to run things at the cheapest rate, which was why this lad at table with us had lines on his face that shouldn't have been there for another 20 years, and was punishing the El Paso vintage as though it were water, without visible effect. Far from pacifying the land, American occupation had made it worse, especially now that the great immigrant incursions were making the redskins sit up and take notice. Not that they needed much encouragement. They'd been ripping the country to shreds for centuries, doing the Spanish and Mexican rules, murdering and plundering at will, exacting blackmail, inflicting frightful tortures on prisoners, carrying off the peons as slaves and concubines, breaking treaties when it suited, and the Dagos had been powerless to stop them. They'd tried military action and been cut to bits. They'd paid Danegeld without avail. Some Mexican officials had even been hand in glove with the tribes, abetting their raids, and the Mexican government had become callous about atrocities it couldn't prevent anyway. The war with America had made matters worse. With the land in confusion, the Indians had had a field day, and now, when America couldn't, or wouldn't, put in enough troops, the Indians treated them with contempt and became more insolent than ever. In effect, they ruled New Mexico, except for the civilized strip down the Del Norte, which they ravaged systematically, just as much as it would bear. It was enough, says Harrison, almost to make him sympathize with the old Mexican Proyecto de Guerra. What's that? Says I. War project? Well, so they called it. A polite name for scalp hunting. Back in the 30s, the Chihuahua Mexicans were so hard-pressed, they paid a bounty for Apache scalps. $100 for a brave, $50 for a female, he grimaced, and $25 for a child. I'm afraid there was no lack of degenerates eager to earn the blood money. The worst was a fellow countryman of yours, I regret to say, a scoundrel called Johnson, who wiped out one of the few peaceful Apache bands and sold their scalps to the Mexicans. Some say it was his massacre that turned the Apaches from regarding white men as allies against Mexico and made them our bitterest enemies. I doubt it, personally. In my experience, Apaches are the most evil, inhuman creatures on earth. If their hostility to Americans is recent, it's because their acquaintance with us barely goes back a generation. The truth is they hate all mankind. In any event, the scalp bounty brought the foulest kind of white cutthroat to this country. They're still here, living by murder and banditry, and in Mexico, which doesn't make our work any easier. No, I couldn't countenance a revival of the Proyecto under American law. But when I think of the horrors I've seen perpetrated by these red savages... He'd been talking, grim-lipped, staring at his glass. A young man riding his hobby horse as only a young man can. But now he broke off in confusion and blushed his apologies to Susie for offending her ears with such talk. "What must you think of me?" he stammered. "Inexcusable, do beg pardon. Oh, gracious, is that the time?" He was just a boy when all was said, bowing over her hand and courteously disputing the bill with me. "You are too kind, sir," says he, all West Point. "When I return, I shall insist on repaying your most enjoyable hospitality. Sir, Mrs. Comer." If you return, thinks I, I'd seen too many gallant pups just like him on the Afghan frontier. And I'd no doubt the Mescaleros, whoever they might be, were just as adroit at subaltern eating as the Afridis.
"Isn't he the sweetest little thing?"
says Susie, looking after him with dewy-eyed lust.
"Honest, sometimes I wish I was just starting in at the game again. I wouldn't charge him a cent."
Fine talk before our lawful wedded, you'll agree. Master Harrison wasn't the only one who'd been overdoing the El Paso.
"Let's have a look at the town, then."
So we took a turn through the bustling, excited streets in the mellow dusk, admiring the magnificent New Mexican sunset and the colorful crowds in the plaza. Every posada and place of amusement seemed to be at full steam and packed with pleasure seekers, for it was abundantly evident that if many of the immigrants out in the wagons and shanties were on their beam ends, there was a multitude in Santa Fe with money to burn. I'd seen nothing like it since New Orleans. The booze was flowing like buttermilk. There was laughter and music wherever you turned, and enough gold and silver and jewelry inside to start a mint. The fashions were brilliant in the Spanish style. Tall caballeros in fancy shirts and bright mangas, their flared calzonero pantaloons slashed from hip to ankle and held with silver buttons. Puros, cigars, clenched between their teeth and embroidered sombreros hanging from their shoulders by silver cords. They sauntered arrogantly by or lounged on the corners with the gaudy poblana wenches. Those are working-class beauties. Or watched as the slim señoritas of the better class swirled past on high Spanish heels, their silks of every colour dazzling in the lamplight. By Jove, it was the place for wanton black eyes and sleek black hair and creamy skin and heady perfume, wasn't it, though? With a great flirting of silken ankles and gracefully held fans and fringed rebosos. Fringed scarfs, that is, worn round the head. Not a buckskin man or Yankee trader or vaquero, but had a slender hand on his arm and a pretty dark head nestling against his shoulder as he strode, or reeled, from posada to dance hall, roaring and singing as he went. There were plenty of wealthy Americans of good class, local ranchers and merchants, as well as mountain men, trappers, and miners from the Albuquerque diggings, all getting rid of their pelf as though it was Judgment Day tomorrow. Noisy, insistent peasant men and women, who hawked Indian trinkets or shrilled and quarrelled round the lighted booths. Young emigrant men who still had some cash left and were eager for the flesh pots. And in the shadows, the beggars and leperos, squatting against the walls. And the Indians. Not just your verminous indios mansos, that's tame Indians as opposed to bravos, but tall, silent figures in their blankets and serapes, own brothers to the fighting braves we'd seen on the prairies, who simply watched with blank faces, or passed without word or glance through the boisterous throng. We looked in at a fandango, one of the famous public dances held in the sala, or ballroom, at one side of the plaza. It was simply a great hall, bare as a riding school, with benches against either wall, one side for men, t'other for women, and a dais at one end for the musicians, a demented group of grinning greasers who thrashed away on bandolins, guitars, tambourines, and drums. It was mostly that gay, heady Spanish stuff, which I like. I'm not a dancer much, but I love to watch experts at work, especially female ones, and the sight of those bright-eyed, laughing poblanas in their polka jackets and short skirts, whirling as they stamped and clattered their heels, would have done you good to see. They wheeled, graceful as gulls, whoever their partners, elegant hatchet-faced dagos in mangas, red-faced sports sodden on Taos whiskey or vino, bearded miners in slouch hats and red shirts, or great clumsy buckskin brigadiers who whooped and yelled and capered like Indians. It says a lot for the band, or the liquor, that there was a Latin sarabando in progress at one end of the hall, while an obstreperous bunch of trappers were performing a Virginia reel at the other, to the satisfaction of all. But even the drunkest gave room when a fat little chap in belled sleeves and sash took the floor, with a tall, crazy-eyed virago in a scarlet silk manga and flounced skirt. They weren't the bonniest couple there. Her moustache was a shade thinner than mine, but she clacked her castanets and surged like a stately galleon, and the little chap, perspiring buckets, clapped and twirled and fairly rattled round her. As the pace increased, everyone yelled and stamped, Viva! Vaya! Ole! Oyentoe! Little greaser! Hurrah! Bella Manola! Bueno! And when they danced side by side from one end of the long sala to the other, both bolt upright and progressing at a snail's pace, although their heels drummed the floor too fast for the eye to follow, and concluded with a great flourish and stamp, the roof was like to come off. They bowed, panting, to the storm of applause, and the spectators showered them with gold and silver and even jewels. I saw one beauty undo her earrings and toss them, crying, Brava! Onto the boards, and the stout ranchero with her flung his diamond pin. Well now, says Susie, tapping me arm, let's see what else they do for recreation. And we visited one of the many gaming houses off the plaza, where the punters crowded round tables heavy with doubloons, pesos and dollars, staking on Faro, 21, and every other fool's game you could think of. I gathered Santa Fe was an extravagant, wide-open community, but even I was astonished at the amounts I saw change hands that night. The gamblers of Santa Fe, whether they were drunk traders, flash greasers, desperate immigrants, cold-eyed swells with pistols prominently displayed in their waistbands, or even the couple of tonsured priests who had an apparently bottomless satchel of coin and crossed themselves before every cast of the dice, were evidently no pikers. They were artfully encouraged by the croupiers, many of whom were Mexican belles in low-cut bodices, who took care to bend low over the table when gathering in the stakes, which always makes the loss seem lighter. Presiding was the celebrated Doña Tules, a Juno with long, dark red hair and splendid shoulders, who smoked a cigarro and lounged among the tables with a court of admirers in tow. "Cheap and showy," sniffed Susie, "and her padding shows, too. Well, that only leaves one other entertainment, doesn't it?" So to my embarrassment, we sought out the best bordello in town. "You want me to go in?" says I, taken aback. "What, you're coming too? Yeah, they'll charge me corkage." But she told me not to be lewd and shoved me inside. It was a poor enough place with a slatternly madame who eyed Susie suspiciously, but drummed up her tarts on request, and an indifferent lot they were. "I see," says Susie. "No, thank you, dear. The gentleman's not staying. He's a clergyman seeing the world." When we were back in the coach and rolling out to camp, she said suddenly, "Well, that settles it. They can keep Sacramento for the present anyway. Well, there's more loose money and good custom in this town than ever I hope to see in California. And I'm about sick of wagons and Indians and travelling, aren't you? A million, did I say? With girls like ours and the kind of star we can show 'em, it'll be like picking it off the trees. I think we'll just settle down for a spell," says she to my consternation. She patted my knee with a plump hand and settled back contentedly. "I think we're going to like Santa Fe, dearie." Chapter 9. There was no sense in arguing, so I didn't. For one thing, I had no wish to plunge ahead into the kind of horror we'd experienced on the plains, and the prospect of a brief rest in Santa Fe was welcome. On the other hand, I'd no wish to linger in America, and was determined to get out of Susie's fond embrace as soon as the chance arose. One pressing need would be money. Like so many of my women, including my dear Elspeth, I regret to say, she seemed devilish reluctant to let me get my paws on the purse strings. They're a mean sex, you know. So I had to take stock and see what offered, while pretending a great interest in the establishment of our brothel. Susie got her eye on a likely place just off the plaza, a fine one-story house with plenty of rooms and a good-sized courtyard, all enclosed by high adobe walls. It belonged to the church, so she paid a rare price. "But never fear," says she. "We'll make 400% on this when we come to sell." Then she hired labour to make it habitable, engaged servants and porters, and furnished it with the gear from New Orleans which had survived our journey. My respect for her increased when I saw all the stuffs, carpets, curtains, china and crockery, tables, chairs and beds, including the famous electrical mattress, too, and realized that she'd never have come by anything half so fine west of St. Louis. Up went the mirrors, chandeliers and pictures, and out came the girls' assorted finery. Susie saw to the very last detail of their personal apartments, and the appointment of the public rooms, which included a large reception chamber where the wenches could be on view between engagements, so to speak, flirting with the customers while they made their selections. A buffet and a gaming room, which I undertook to supervise. But there's no call, you know, for a man about the bawdy house, apart from the porter bullies, and I didn't care to be seen as a mere jack-gagger. One who lives off immoral earnings, that is. Also, it occurred to me that I'd be able to accumulate some private funds with careful management. We opened for business with Susie dressed like a dog's dinner, queening it in the hall, her cashier in an office to one side, and a broken-down medico in a little room on the other. "For the only thing they're going to leave here is cash," says she, "and if they don't like being looked at by the pox spotter, they can take themselves off double quick." The girls were all got up in their most alluring finery, lounging artlessly in the reception on their couches under the shaded lamps, while Flashy, resplendent in new coat and pants and silk cravat, shuffled the decks in the gaming room and waited for the girls. And I'm here to tell you that I did a damn thin trade. You see, they could gamble anywhere in Santa Fe, but they couldn't fornicate in the style to which Susie's charmers quickly accustomed them. It was like a madhouse out yonder for a couple of hours, until she closed the doors, having made appointments for clients who kept us busy until 4 in the morning. And when I joined her at dawn and saw the pile of rhino on her office table, well, there was a cool $4,000 if there was a cent.
"Mind you, I won't have the girls working at this pace other nights," says she. "It's important to make a good impression at first. The word will spread and we'll attract good custom. But then we can pick and choose the real genteel and put the prices up. I'm not having those dirty buckskin brutes in here again, though. They're just savages. Poor little Mari had to call the porters twice, she was that terrified. And Jeanette might have been hurt bad if she hadn't had her pistol handy."
I saw there was more to this business than I'd imagined, but by George, wasn't it a paying spec, though? Better than stock jobbing or army contracts, and just as respectable, really. We throve astonishingly in that first week, just as Susie had predicted. Our fame spread and the Dago quality began to come in, not only from Santa Fe, but from the valley below Albuquerque, even, and the rancherias in the country round. We had a rare platoon of bullies on the gate, and took no riffraff. Even so, there was no lack of customers, and since they weren't the kind to haggle, she was able to exact prices that she confessed she wouldn't have dreamed of charging in Orleans. Oh, she knew her business. Taste and refinement, says she, are what we're after, and she got it. I've known rowdier drawing rooms in Belgravia. The tarts seem to thrive on it, too. You've never seen such airs. One thing that alarmed us both, though, was the amount of cash that piled up in Susie's strongbox in that first week. It would have given you the frights anywhere, never mind in a town awash with sharps and slicks who'd have cut a throat for 20 cents. In New Orleans, she'd have banked it, but here there wasn't a strong room worth the name. Trust Susie, though. In no time, she'd reached an arrangement with one of the governor's aides, and every second or third day, the box was hefted across the plaza by a couple of bluecoats, and the blunt stowed under military guard at headquarters. I fancy the aide's fee was free use of Eugenie every Friday, but I'm not certain. Susie was close about business arrangements. But she confided that she still wasn't happy about keeping large sums on the premises between times, and perhaps we ought to hire a reliable guard. I remarked that I was on hand, and she went slightly pink and said, "Yes, love, but I couldn't be awake all the time, could I? I was thinking we might employ Nugent Eyre," she added. I didn't care for this. He and Uncle Dick Wooden have been paid off with the arrieros and teamsters on Susie's resolve to settle in Santa Fe, but while Wooden had gone off with a hunting party, the bold Grattan was still about the town. I was against taking him back, I said. I didn't care for him.
"He's been a loyal servant to us, you can't deny. What's wrong with him, then?"
"He's Irish and his nose is too long, and I've never trusted him above half."
"Not trust him 'cause his nose is too long? Whatever do you mean?"
Suddenly she burst out laughing, catching my hand.
"Here, I do believe you're jealous. Why, you silly big thing, come here. You are, aren't you?"
She was bubbling with delight at the idea and kissed me warmly, as if I could ever think of anyone but you. She was all sentimental in a moment, her arms round my neck.
"Oh, Beach, I do love you so. Now then, let's chase them blue devils away."
The result was that Grattan was sought out and offered the post of chief of the knocking shop police, which he accepted, pulling his long nose and bland as he pleased. I was surprised, because while I'll do anything myself, he didn't strike me as the sort who'd lure himself to being a whore's ruffian, which is what it amounted to. We discovered why he'd been so ready 2 days later, when the son of a bitch slipped his cable with $2,000, which, fortunately, was all that had been in the office desk. Susie was distraught, damning his eyes and bewailing her foolishness in not heeding me. I was quite pleased myself and comforted her by saying we'd have the scoundrel by the heels in no time. But at this she clutched my hand and begged me not to. "Why the hell not?" cries I, dumbfounded.
"Oh, it wouldn't do. Honest, I know it wouldn't. Let the thieving little bastard go, and good riddance. Oh, the swine, if I could lay hands on him. No, no, darling, let it be. It'll be cheaper in the long run. It gets a place like ours such a bad name, you see, if there's any commotion with the law. Really, it does. I know. Anyway, God knows where he's gone by this. No, please, Beachy love, take my word on it. Let it go. $2,000? Damned if I do. Oh, darling, I know, but it ain't worth it. We'd lose by it in the end. Please. I know it's my fault, and I should have listened to you and not trusted the long red snake that he is. But I'm soft and silly. Please, let it alone for my sake.
She was so insistent that in the end I shrugged it away. It wasn't my pelf anyway, but I kept my thoughts to myself, and she calmed down presently and promised that we would make it back 100-fold in no time at all, which I could well believe, seeing how business was in the second week. Our clients were more numerous than ever, and their enthusiasm showed itself in an entirely unexpected way, to me at any rate, although Susie said it had been common enough in New Orleans, and was regarded as a great compliment to the establishment. For now we began to receive repeated offers from the wealthier patrons, who wanted to buy one or other of the girls outright. I recall one enormously fat greaser with an oiled moustache and rings sparkling on his pudgy hands, sweating all over his lecherous moon face as he made Susie a bid for Marie. She was the delicate little mulatto with soulful eyes whose prime trick, I gathered, was to burst into tears beforehand.
"She is so frail and sweet like a fresh flower," cries this disgusting bag of lard. "She must be mine. The price I do not care. Name it and I pay. Only I must have her for my own to protect and cherish. She consumes me, the little helado negro."
Susie smiled and shook her head.
"But I couldn't do that, Senor Cascada de los Pantalones, even for you. Why, I'd soon have no girls left, and then where'd I be? They're not for sale. But I must have her. I will care for her like my most precious brood mare. She shall have an apartment in my hacienda, with perfumed crystals for her bath, and pompons, and a silk coverlet, and a pet dog from Chihuahua."
"I'm sure she would," says Susie firmly, "'cause you're a real gentleman, I know, but there's the law too, isn't there? This ain't slave territory, and I've been a real fix if word got out.
Ah, the Americano law, who cares? Would it be known, or should hear of it?"
He grimaced like a sow in labour, and wheedled horrid.
"Are there not thousands of slaves? What are the peons but chattels? Do not Los Indios own many slaves, stolen and bought? And what does the law know about them? Please, Miss Coma, I beg of you, $3,000-$4,000 even, what you will, por Dios, so I may possess my pure, my delicious, angelic Marie."
But he wouldn't have it for all his groans and entreaties, and he went off lamenting to console himself on rented terms with his little black ice cream, as he'd called her. Susie sent all other would-be buyers the same road, including one I'd not have credited if I hadn't been present as translator. Believe it or not, he was a priest. Aye, from the mission just up the Santa Fe Trail, a spruce little runt of impeccable address who came in secrecy after dark, and hastened to explain that he wasn't a customer personally, but acting on behalf of an important client.
"He has erred, as who has not, of the beauty and refinement of the young ladies who are under the senora's care," says he.
And from his very smoothness I scented a wrong one from the start.
"I must make it clear immediately that my patron's intentions are of the most honourable. Otherwise it is unthinkable that I should act as his intermediary. But he is of consequence and wishes to take the young lady to wife. He understands the senora's position and is prepared to pay substantial compensation."
When I'd recovered and translated for Susie, she was so took aback that she didn't offer her usual polite refusal, but asked who the patron was and which gal did he want, for God's sake. I passed it back, and the pimping padre shook his head.
I should not divulge his name as to his choice. He knows of your ladies only by report and is indifferent. He would prefer, however, that she is not too black.
Susie, hearing this, said she was prepared to wager it was his bloody bishop. Staunch Church of England was Susie.
Tell him we regret our girls ain't for sale, whatever name he gives it,
says she.
Compensation, indeed. A marriage? A likely tale.
He was a persistent little terrier, though, and urged the importance of his patron, the unspecified amount he would cough up, and as a last resort the desirability of giving a poor whore the chance to go straight in wedlock. He didn't put it like that quite. Susie shook her head grimly and repeated her line about the law being the law, and the girls not being in the market anyway. He took himself off, poker-faced, and Susie was remarking that it was always celibacy that made him randy as stoats, when I voiced a doubt that had occurred to me before. Hold on, says I, if it's true what you've been telling them, is this free territory? Because if it is, what's to hinder one of the girls from marrying a suitor? Or little Marie going off with old Pantalunas, or whatever he's called. I mean, maybe they'd rather jolly a single party, with all home comforts as wives or mistress, than be thumped by four different randies every night. And if slave law don't run here, why, the whole pack of them could walk out and leave you flat.
You think I'm simple, don't you? Says she. Why, I knew all of that before I left Orleans. Leave me flat? Why should they do that? And where'd they go, silly little sluts that don't know nothing except how to proper man up? Trust themselves to some oily villain like old Cascara chops, who'd turn them out as soon as he'd tired of them. That much they do know now. And they haven't the wit to work their own lay, unprotected. They wouldn't last a week. With me, they're well off, well fed, and I'll treat them fair. They're never driven or ill-used, and they know that when they're past their prime, I'll see them set up proper. Yes, or married, some steady fella that I approve of. How many whores do you know in England with prospects as good as my girls? That's another thing. They are my girls, and they'd not leave me. No, not for 20 pantalunises. You see, law or no law, they're still slaves in here.
And she tapped her forehead.
And I'm Miss Susie, and always will be.
Well, she was the best judge, but I had doubts. I could think of one at least of her houris who was not a silly little slut, and who could see horizons wider than those visible in the ceiling mirrors of Susie's private salons. One Clearney, to wit, who'd been more passionately attentive to me than ever since our arrival in Santa Fe. There was a little summer house hidden deep in the pines near the back gate, and when occasion offered, she and I would repair to it for field exercises. Since I was preparing to bid Susie adieu, I didn't heed the risk, but Clearney's eagerness astonished me. I'd have thought she'd have enough of men to sicken her, but apparently not. I discovered why one afternoon when everyone else was at siesta, and I was sitting meditating in the dim, stuffy little summer house, with Clearney astride my lap, going like a drunk jockey and humming,
Il était un berger,
when she'd panted her soul out, and I'd got a cheroot going, she suddenly says,
How much do you love me, chérie?
I told her oceans, and hadn't I just proved it? But she kept asking me, teasing at me with her lips, her eyes alight in the shadows. So I reassured her that she was the only girl for me, no error. She considered a moment with a little smile.
You do not love me, Susie, and soon you will be leaving her, will you not?
I started so hard I nearly unseated her, and she gave a little laugh and kissed me again.
There is no need to be alarmed, only I know it, and that because I had a Haitian mother and we can see. I see it in the way you look at her, just as I see what is in your eyes when you look at me. Ah!
And she shivered against me.
Why should you love her? She is fat and old, and I am young and beautiful, n'est-ce pas?
If when you're 50 you can light my fire half as well as Susie can, thinks I, you'll be doing damn well, my conceited little fancy. But of course I told her different. She'd given me a turn with her prophecy, and I guess what was coming next.
When you go,
she whispers.
Why do you not take me with you? Where will you go? Mexico? We could be very happy in Mexico for a while. I could make money for us there, and on the way, with you to protect me. If you love me as you say you do, why do not we go together?
Who says I'm going, though? I haven't. And if Miss Susie heard one word of this, and what you've said about her, well, I think caning was the least you could expect. She'd sell you down the river, my girl.
Proof she cannot sell me. This is free soil. You think we don't know? And that she has said as much to those who came to buy us? Oh, yes, we know that, too. Already black Aphrodite is listening to that fat man. What is his name? Pantaloon. He who wished to buy Marie, only Marie is silly and timid.
Aphrodite is not timid. She is of a force, as I am, even if she is black and rank and lacks education.
I think she will go.
So much for loyalty to the dear old brothel, thinks I. And what about the others?
She shrugged.
Stupid little oars, what do they know? They would be lost without the fat Miss Susie to waddle after them like a foolish old hen.
She giggled and arched that superb body.
I shall go, whether she like or not, with you, because even if you do not love me as you say, you enjoy me. And I enjoy you as I've never enjoyed any man before. So I think we will march well together. To Mexico, eh? I'm there if you please. I shall make an establishment, even as Fat Susie has done. Or, if I wish, I may find a wealthy man and marry him. When will you go?
It wasn't such a bad notion when I thought of it. Not unlike my flight with Cassie along the Mississippi. But this one, while she might lack Cassie's iron will and resource, and I wouldn't have bet on that, had advantages Cassie had lacked. She was educated, highly intelligent, a linguist, a lady when she chose, and was ready to work her passage. That would see me right for cash, which had been vexing me. And she could keep me warm at nights, too, even better than Cassie, who'd been a cool fish when all was said. And when we decamped, dear Susie could do nothing about it. Clearly, it was free as air. We could travel by easy stages down the Del Norte Valley, which was safe enough, to El Paso. And once in Mexico, I could let her make sufficient to buy me a passage to England. I couldn't see a hole in it, and I was chafing to be away. The long and short of it was that we discussed it until the end of the siesta, and I couldn't for the life of me see why it shouldn't be put in train at once. She was a smart wench, and had it well figured out. I must procure a couple of mounts for the journey, which could be done in the morning, and assemble what packages we needed. I had enough ready money for that, and she had almost $100 of her own, typique, from satisfied customers in Orléans and here in Santa Fe. So we should be all right to begin with.